identify what is the center of our existence, what is the true central being, as he calls it, and also brought into attention through the process how complex the inner nature is, composed of what seems to be a fragmented nature, but with some semblance of centralization on the surface. But then he goes behind this to locate other possible centers, that which gives us a certain kind of consistency of operation. To some extent, there is a consistency of operation which is almost unconscious to human beings. That is another, you may say, aspect of centralization beyond the more superficial, illusory notion of the ego. Now, that deeper sense of centralization, which is almost unconscious, arises from what Sri Aurobindo is calling the central being, which in any case is some particular aspect of either the physical being, the vital being, or the mental being. Each one of these, again, is made up of nature, which is itself diverse, expresses itself through a variety of characteristics, which could be related to personalities, and behind them there is a being, which, or Purusha, which is more stable, free of the operation of all those personalities, and has a certain kind of relational independence, if one might call it, with regard to the nature. Now, in each particular case, this is what gives that sense of consistency, if one can arrive at a kind of independence from the operations of the ego, a degree of independence from the operations of the ego. Or if we look at the ego merely as a kind of shifting center that is arising due to our relations in the world, it is being formed. It's the subject, the formation of the subject through our relations with the environment. Now, behind this, if that can be to some extent overcome, there begins arising some sense of consistency in action related to one of these three beings and some aspect of their nature. This is what allows us to get a sense of character, let's say, or of expression, which has some durability to it. That is what we can, on the face of it, call swadharma, personal law of becoming. Each person seems to proceed along a certain law of becoming. This law of becoming, as I said, is often largely unconscious, but it expresses itself through certain preferences of interest, which are not just of the surface. That's what makes them, in fact, largely unconscious. That's what allows, for example, the unpredictable terms of our life. Sometimes when something suddenly comes up into the life, and we find that we are pulled into a certain trajectory, of expression, our interest is kindled from some source that we didn't even know existed. Sometimes it's not so sudden as that, but builds through gradual kinds of acts of cause and effect. We find ourselves given certain opportunities, and we don't even think why it is we choose something over others, but we do choose. And this choice, if it is not one which is really determined by the superficial pressures of environment, may have something to do with this deeper part in us, that then brings results which magnifies choices of a similar kind. And we find that we are developing a certain consistency, one may say, in interest or in expression. This is sometimes more easy to recognize from the outside and in oneself. But with a certain amount of growth, one even discovers that in oneself. One finds a predictability in one's own actions beyond one's superficial choice. And that ultimately is a sense of Swadharma, law of becoming, and Swabhava, law of being, that one carries with one. Now, this is related to what is called the central being, which we have a rough, shady sense of. This shadiness arises because we don't have a grasp on it. That particular being is being represented through one of these three beings, physical, vital, or mental beings. Now, Sri Aurobindo has gone through all the various paragraphs of this chapter before to point to the fact that each of these beings has independent realities and therefore an independent trajectory of growth. And depending on which of these is expressing the central Swabhava and Swadharma, or better put, depending on what the Swabhava and Swadharma is expressing itself through, we find a certain kind of predominance in nature. But if we are to arrive at the fullness of a sense of centrality, we find that what it is representing goes even beyond these three beings to a true central being which can utilize them, and in some ways utilizing one more than others, but to another extent can utilize them all. So that's where Sri Aurobindo starts talking about the psychic being. And where we are right now is where he is bringing forth the idea that psychic being is something which has to come to the front. To arrive at that, there has to be a process, because it is not easy, since it is so deeply hidden within the folds of the personality. So the paragraph that the two paragraphs before where we are right now, he began with this notion of moving back. First he talks about what we know as the triple yoga of knowledge, works, and devotion. How to bring all of them together, just as the Gita recommends. But he proceeds from there to say that such a yoga, so long as it is working as a discipline of practice in the nature, can remain on the surface but as a preparation. But to arrive at the truth of the psychic being, this preparation has to be enhanced by gradual moving inwards to the sources of personality. What is it that is doing the yoga? Where is the personality centered? So that brings him into the idea of coming into contact with the true beings of physical, vital, and mental nature. That is the physical Purusha, vital Purusha, and mental Purusha. Of course, he starts from the other way around because it's easiest for us to detach the witness from the mind. It's much more difficult to detach the witness from the desires or from the emotions. It is even more difficult to detach the witness from the automatisms of the body. Though disciplines such as Hatha Yoga have been developed, to make that more possible, experiences of the pure physical Purusha can be had in the knowledge of something in the physical consciousness that is not the body, and yet which can uphold the operations of the body. Similarly, similar kind of, you know, experience can be had at the level of the vital, where one experiences a wide and silent Purusha, upholding the movements of the feelings, the emotions, and the sensations, the ambitions, and all these kinds of things, but not touched by them. Sri Aurobindo proceeds to tell us that perhaps by becoming aware of the mental Purusha and then pulling backward to experience that that particular mental Purusha is not only free of mind, but its representatives are also present in vital and physical consciousness. The Purusha behind has, you know, all these components to it. Then one can develop what he has elsewhere called the yogic consciousness. That is, the ability to control the movements of the Prakriti. Thereby one has a purification, a power of purification that can operate in one. But Sri Aurobindo points out that that is not enough, because by itself, these Purushas are firstly separated from each other. And secondly, they don't have creative or transformative effects. They have at the best the effect of negation of the actions of Prakriti. They can rein the horses. They can't change the mind of the horses. So as a result, one has to go even further and find the root of these Purushas in the psychic being within. And Sri Aurobindo points out that the most effective way of doing it is to combine all this kind of process with the act of surrender to the Ishvara, to the divine being, to the supreme being. So that surrender brought into every one of our attempts, brought into the idea of the Purusha and the Prakriti and their action, eventually results in the psychic being coming to the front. Now the psychic being comes to the front in a process, through a process. That process consists in gradually taking hold of the nature. So that which was operating through either the physical, mental, or vital Purusha on the physical, mental, or vital Prakriti is now going to express its own qualitative nature, not just its presence or its power of negation, but its Prakriti itself, the psychic Prakriti itself, on or through the nature of the physical, mental, and vital beings, gradually changing their qualities. So that is what he talks about, leading to greater consciousness and what he calls the cracking of the crust of the outer nature. As the crust of the outer nature cracks, as the walls of inner separation break down, the inner light gets through, the inner fire burns in the heart, the substance of the nature and the stuff of consciousness refined to a greater subtlety and purity, and the deeper psychic experiences, those which are not solely of inner mental or inner vital character, become possible in this subtler, purer, finer substance. The soul begins to unveil itself. The psychic personality reaches its full stature. So this is how Sri Aurobindo presents this idea of the emergence of the psychic being. The reason it cannot emerge is because the nature is not giving it the kind of soil in which it can take root. Therefore, it is only through that particular transformation that the psychic being itself can enter its own maturity. Psychic evolution is twofold. On the one level, psychic evolution is the gradual self-formation into the human nature through the assumption of the qualities of human nature. That is, a psychicized mentality, a psychicized vitality, and a psychicized physicality. And this aspect of the psychic evolution can only develop to the extent that nature is transformed by it, allows itself to be subtilized by it, to be refined by it. And that is the process he's talking about. The other aspect of the psychic evolution is to go beyond the human personality and form in the human those capacities that are yet to be born. That is the reversal of consciousness and the assumption of the mantle of evolution, which heretofore was assumed by Prakriti, acting under the direction of cosmic Prakriti. So this part is where we are right now. This is a very important step, which Sri Aurobindo is pointing out, that as the psychic being changes the consciousness of the inner nature, one opens up not only to the inner psychic presence, but to a streaming of a variety of experiences. The ontology changes, the nature of human being changes. What is my experience of being? That changes. For one, there is a sense of the divine. This question as to does the divine exist or not is no longer a debatable issue. The sense, the concrete sense of the divine all around us, the concrete sense of the evolution as a growth towards the fullness of divinity, the sense of the divine above in relationship with the human being becomes established. Now, along with it, a variety of other kinds of experiences start opening up, which are actually of the nature of the relationship between the divine and the soul. All these experiences cause the personality to become immersed in, as it were, another kind of experience of being. An experience of being in which the primary reality is the relationship between the soul and the divine. The secondary reality is the relationship of the soul and the world and its entities seen as part of that relationship of the soul and the divine. Now, this entire, evolution in itself is so glorious, as Sri Aurobindo spells it out in that paragraph where we stopped. Actually, we went on further, but the one that you're talking about where we stopped.
Sure, I think we went on.
That it is very easy to suppose that that is the culmination of human evolution. But Sri Aurobindo is pointing out that that is perhaps as far as our human nature as it is constituted at present can go. That is, given that cosmic nature has formed a certain type of consciousness called physical consciousness, a certain type called vital, a certain type called mental, and each one of these forms of consciousness have a certain type of personalized activity in the separativeness of evolution that has developed, that can reach this point and be fulfilled with a psychic transformation. But the psychic transformation is not the full divinization. And if the psychic being emerges to its full degree, automatically there is a thirst and an opening towards the further reaches of the psychic evolution, which is essentially to cosmicize itself and to completely divinize itself. The trajectory of the psychic evolution naturally proceeds towards a cosmicizing of the particular. The particular is the universal is first seen through the prism of the particular. But later, once that has reached a certain pitch, that is added to the experience of the universal. The experience of the cosmic must subsist as a reality in itself. That is the next step. And going even beyond that, the entire universal movement, the entire universal creation must be seen as a becoming of the Supreme Being by its own self-choice. And that union can only take place at a further remove from the consciousness of the psychic in its human manifestation by entering into unity with the supracosmic or the supramental. So those are the further reaches, and so Sri Aurobindo over here is opening up that particular possibility at the end of his discussion on psychic transformation.
Devashishda, thank you for the summary. It's very nice. Could you expand a bit on the last part, what you said about, how with the current Prakriti, that's as far as we can go, and that is what is being interpreted as the maximum, but it's only that the current constitution allows only this far, but a different constitution can take us further.
Yes, the psychic transformation is operating through the consciousness in which it is embedded, in which the psychic being is embedded. And that is the consciousness that cosmic Prakriti has prepared. Cosmic Prakriti has molded, as it were, out of the ignorance, these instruments of the ignorance, and given them to the divine, as it were, to play with. Now, by dint of the fact that these instruments are made up of prakritic substance, the psychic being can infuse them with the quality of consciousness that can make them as divine as possible. See? Mm-hmm. So, that is what is happening with the growth of the psychicization of the nature. But, beyond a certain point, psychic being finds these particular instruments to be ignorant because the modality of consciousness cannot be overcome. Modality of consciousness is a certain type of, chosen delimitation in the range of consciousness. So we find that matter, life and mind, see this we find also in the case for example, Bhrigu's tapasya. We can arrive even at the experience of the divine, of the Brahman, at any of these levels. We can say Annam Brahma. We can say Pranam Brahma. We can say Mano Brahma. This is what Bhrigu actually realizes. Each of these realizations of the Brahman is a certain kind of modulation of consciousness that nevertheless is not inclusive of everything. See, it is finding Brahman in matter. See, but it's like saying matter is nothing but Brahman. But as a matter of fact, we cannot turn around and say Brahman is nothing but matter. See, this is where the problem lies about the limitation of consciousness. This is why Bhrigu is constantly asked to exceed whatever he had thought was Brahman, until he comes to Anandam Brahma, because that is the fount of things. That is what has become Annam, Pranam, Mano, etc., even Vijnanam for that matter. So, until we find that source of expression where we can say Prakriti and Purusha are completely united, we have not found the adequate means for the expression of the divine in nature. So, cosmic nature has yielded up these particular vehicles or these particular modalities of consciousness. But in these modalities of consciousness, the nature that is offered is not equal to the Purusha that is manifesting through them. See, divine Purusha needs fully divine Prakriti. That fully divine Prakriti is not obtained in matter, life or mind. Therefore, psychic being comes to a certain limit of its own development and proceeds further. It takes these to a point where experiences of divinity, of the divine, can be had at these levels. That's why he talks about those, that entire range of experiences. But evolutionarily speaking, there are limitations in these modalities, which is why it has to proceed further to find a nature, a kind of Prakriti, which is totally free and totally creative and knows itself to be nothing other than Brahman. You see, that's why it proceeds further. Now we can also see this to some extent as the trajectory of Savitri in her movement towards the finding of her soul. The idea of the finding of her soul proceeds through these three levels of matter, life and mind, and the godheads of these established godheads of these Prakritic formations, each one offering to be nothing but the Supreme Divine Mother. But she cannot accept them because she sees their limitations. Each one is eventually shown to be limited by her own vahana. The vahana, the carrier of each of these powers of Godhead, each of these Shaktis, is unable to give the full divinity of expression to these Shaktis. That's the reason why, even though they try, they cannot ultimately transform the creation. So, understanding that, the emergent soul realizes that it has to go further and find its source, its true home, beyond these formulations the cosmic Prakriti has accepted as the sacrifice of Purusha into the ignorance. It has to take responsibility for the sacrifice. It's the Purusha himself reassuming the responsibility that he has taken in sacrificing himself in its return to its origin.
Thank you, Devashishna. So, is this also related to the boon that Ashwapati gets of Savitri?
Yeah, it is. It is related, but there it is given in a certainly in a different way, because in Ashwapati's case, the journey does not proceed in the same manner as it does, through in Savitri's case, through the finding of the soul. The psychic reality is not really Ashwapati's forte to start with. Ashwapati travels above the mind he becomes a traveler of the worlds. The consciousness rises up and down.
Sure.
So it's more like he proceeds through a cosmicizing of the nature and ultimately enters into the highest planes and brings down this power. Ashwapati's confrontation with the soul only takes place at a certain point where he's reached the acme of mental existence and finds no meaning there. Then he takes a plunge into the world soul. Mind you, there too, it's a cosmic realization of soul. Already cosmic realization of soul rather than an individual realization. In Savitri's case, we find the more classic trajectory that he's drawing out over here. As he'll say, it is possible to go other ways as well. The second of the three transformations, which is The cosmic transformation proceeds through experiences of the cosmic being. Now, these experiences are the more common experiences in most yogas, particularly in Indian yogas. Now, yogas of the world could be said to be divided into two kinds. Some which go for the cosmic realization in some form or the other, and others which go for the dualistic realization of the psychic in some form or the other. The dualistic realization is basically that in which the instruments become the nature instruments become the channel or the vehicle for relationship with the Supreme. But the Supreme and the individual are seen as two different things, with the joy of relationship being the medium of connection. The cosmic realizations, on the other hand, proceed under the assumption or the thirst to abolish any sense of duality and be one with the cosmic being. Cosmic processes usually lead in that direction through the mind enlarging itself or some other part of the being enlarging itself into realization of the divine at some level or the other. Now, in the Ashwapati case, and one may say in Sri Aurobindo's own case, it is this cosmic realization which preceded, and only at a certain point, when it reached a certain kind of meaninglessness in terms of the evolution. Of course, there is no meaninglessness. Everything has meaning to the divine. But in terms of the evolution, the seeking for meaning stops short in any of these ways at a certain point. When you proceed along the cosmic direction, seeking for meaning stops when one has achieved the cosmic realization. The question then arises, what is the meaning of this world? Then you have to give an answer which is based on a realization. So, for example, the Buddhists will say, meaning of this world is it's an illusion, but we have to help people to get out of that illusion. See? So that is based on the realization, cosmic realization reached. For Sri Aurobindo, that was not sufficiently justifiable. And that's what brings this notion of the word soul, a universal consciousness which gives meaning to the evolution. Now, on the other hand, proceeding along the dualistic line, a similar dead end is reached because one experiences the relationship with the divine and the joy of the relationship with the divine. It's as Ramakrishna said, I don't want to eat sugar. I don't want to be sugar. I want to eat sugar. So that is the mark of superiority from that point of view. They claim that they're superior from that point of view. But it reaches a dead end because that does not give an answer either to what is the meaning of evolution. For that, the soul has to move further and know that this entire creation is one, that it is the one that has become the many for the joy of creation, for the joy of relationship, and that it is not individuals only that are to enter into this kind of realization, but one being is becoming, a single becoming in innumerable forms. That realization can only be had at a cosmic level. I can know that I am in relationship with something cosmic, but it is only when I realize the cosmic fully that I know that the cosmic being has become every one of these smaller becomings. So that's where the limitation of the instruments of matter, life and mind is overcome at the pinnacle of cosmic consciousness, over mental consciousness, you may say, when one realizes that there is one being who is becoming in the cosmos, in innumerable forms. So that's why both these trajectories have to meet. The psychic being has to emerge and proceed further into the cosmic realizations and the transcendental realizations.
Yeah. Thank you, Vashishtha.
Vashishtha, you were mentioning about the Vahanas that Savitri meets of those three soul forces.
Yeah.
I just remember the last Vahana, it was a tigress.
Yes.
What were the first two Vahanas?
Well, it's actually, you're right. I mean, Vahanas, you're quite right. Vahanas, technically speaking, in the first two cases, he does not mention Vahanas. But I'm using the term Vahana in a wider sense, as including the deformed beings of the egoistic representation, the shadow of divinity that falls on the ignorance. You see, in each case, there is a dwarf being that arises with a distorted sort of call. Now, that is also part of the Vahana. The Vahana is a twin kind of reality. There is a purified vital, which is usually what we see as the Vahanas of the gods and goddesses. But even if we think of the notion of Vahana, the limitation of the goddesses arises, which is not shown in our pictures to that extent. But part of their Vahana is also this distorted being. They can't separate themselves from it. They can't master it to that extent that they can actually transform things in the world. So I'm talking about those distorted beings, the dwarf consciousnesses that accompany these goddesses as the Vahana. There's some credence to using the term Vahana there, because idea of the animal mounts in Indian tradition is a slightly later idea. The earlier idea is that of the yakshis who stand on distorted dwarfs. Those distorted dwarfs are these various nature powers that cannot be transformed, that become the shadows of these goddesses.
So it is not in the sense of conveyance.
It's not in the sense of conveyance, but they are also conveyances. You see, they are the conveyance, they are the kind of the perverse or the conveyances that won't go where the Divine Mother wants them to go, you see? Mm-hmm. It's that sense of perverse conveyances. Because every time one of these soul forces speaks, immediately this one also speaks. And what it's saying is an echo of what that mother said, but a distorted echo. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's carrying the same message, but in a distorted form. Mm-hmm. So it is a conveyance, but it's a perverse conveyance. It's a conveyance to the wrong goal.
Mm-hmm. It's a downward conveyance.
Mm-hmm.
So finally, after that, in the next stage, when it became the animals, you used the word the purified vitals.
Yeah, yes.
So the animal is the purified vital of the divine that it conveys.
Quite. That would be, I would say, what these are. These are the two aspects of the vital. One is the higher vital, which lends itself to the light, and the other is the lower vital, which goes against the light. So essentially, these are the two, in the cosmic creation, these are the two powers of the vital. On the one hand, you have a part of the vital, that is what we call the higher vital, that has lent itself to the divine influence. And then we have another part of the vital that has completely twisted the divine influence and has become perverse and continues to be the hostile element in nature.
Shall we begin reading?
Sure.
Monica, would you like to start?
Okay. Hello. Yeah, I'm afraid I don't know where we are because I didn't attend the last session.
This is page 909 if you have the book.
909? Okay. In my book, the paragraph starts with occultism is in its essence. Is this the paragraph?
No. I think actually it might take some time to get to the right page, so maybe you can read next.
Would you like me to read?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. Tremendous experiences can come by an opening of the inner mental and vital being, the inner and larger and subtler mind and heart and mind within us, without any full emergence of the soul, psychic entity, since there truly there is a power of direct contact with consciousness. But the experience might then be of a mixed character, for there could be an emergence not only of the subliminal knowledge, but of the subliminal ignorance. An insufficient expansion of the being, a limitation of mental idea, by narrow and selective emotion, or by the form of the temperament, so that there would be only an imperfect self-belief and action, and not the free soul emergence, even occur. In the absence of any or of a complete psychic emergence, experiences of certain kinds, experiences of greater knowledge and force, a surpassing of the ordinary limits, might lead to a magnified ego, and even bring about instead of an outflowering of what is divine or spiritual, an uprush of the titanic or demoniac, or might call in agencies and powers which, though not of this disastrous type, but are of a powerful but inferior cosmic character. But the rule and guidance of the soul brings into all experience the tendency of light, of integration, of harmony, and intimate rightness, which is nature to the psychic essence. A psychic, or more widely speaking, a psycho-spiritual transformation of this kind would be already a vast change of our mental human nature.
So here he's talking about something that we've already touched on, just touched on, which is that it could be possible to experience some aspect of the Brahman directly without the psychic coming to the front. That was what I was saying about Bhrigus Tapasya, for example. Either through, and he starts by saying, some of these experiences can come by an opening of the inner mental and vital being, the inner and larger and subtler mind and heart of, and light within us, without any full emergence of the soul, the psychic entity, since there too, there is a power of direct contact of consciousness. So that is the thing, that ultimately because there is a mental Purusha, there is a vital Purusha, there is a physical Purusha, there is a ability to contact Brahman, or Purusha, cosmic Purusha, in any one of these levels. So there is an access to the divine, one may say. But the fact of the matter is that in Prakriti, in terms of Prakriti, these are levels that are also highly compromised by the action of ignorance and falsehood. So the first thing is, in the emergence of the evolutionary force, that is, if we are to talk about the full evolution of human existence, or even the evolution of cosmic existence through human agency, then we have to find the way by which the soul or the psychic being can effect the reversal of consciousness. That becomes the key. That's the real key. Otherwise, we could be highly satisfied with some contact with the divine existence at any one of these levels. We would say that we know the divine exists, and who cares if some little part of our being is still unpurified, or if even it lends itself to some undivine action. You know, the Shurabindo has a poem about this, about the yogi who, you know, stomachs God is, you know, angry. And he says that, you know, anger, I don't care about if my nature expresses anger. I have known the divine and that's all I care. The point is that that is fine as far as that kind of goal is concerned. But if we are to talk about the evolution of consciousness, then we have to find the lever by which the consciousness can proceed to its fullness, can proceed out of the ignorance into the fullness of the divine reality. For that, it is very necessary that the psychic being prepares the nature to whatever extent it can. That's the reason why whether mind, life and physical can experience some touch of the Brahman or not, the psychic being has to prepare the nature and emerge in its fullness and then proceed from that point. That's what he's saying.
Monica, do you want to read the next one?
Yes, okay. But all this change and all this experience, though psychic and spiritual in essence and character, would still be in its paths of life effectuation on the mental, vital and physical level. Its dynamic spiritual outcome would be a flowering of the soul in mind and life and body. But in act and form, it would be circumscribed within the limitations, however enlarged, uplifted, and rarefied, of an inferior instrumentation. It would be a reflected and modified manifestation of things whose full reality, density, largeness, oneness, diversity of truth and power and delight are above us, above mind, and therefore above any perfection within mind's own formula of the foundations or superstructure of our present nature. A higher spiritual transformation must intervene on the psychic and psycho-spiritual change, the psychic movement inwards to the inner being, the self or divinity within us, must be completed by an opening upwards to a supreme spiritual status or a higher existence. This can be done by our opening into what is above us, by an ascent of consciousness into the ranges of overmind and supramental nature, in which the sense of self and spirit is ever unveiled and permanent, and in which the self-luminous instrumentation of the spirit, of the self and spirit, is not restricted or divided as in our mind nature, life nature, body nature. This also the psychic change makes possible, for as it opens us to the cosmic consciousness now hidden from us by many walls of limiting individuality, so also it opens us to what is now superconscient, to our normality, because it is hidden from us by the strong heart and right lid of mind, mind constricting, dividing and separative. The lid thins, is lit, breaks asunder and opens and disappears under the pressure of the psycho-spiritual change and the natural urge of the new spiritualized consciousness towards that of which it is an expression here. This effectuation of an aperture and its consequences may not at all take place if there is only a partial psychic emergence satisfied with the experience of the divine reality in the normal degrees of the spiritualized mind. But if there is an awakening to the existence of the higher supernormal levels, then an aspiration towards them may break the lid or operate a rift in it. This may happen long before the psycho-spiritual change is complete, or even before it has well begun or proceeded far, because the psychic personality has become aware and has an eager concentration towards the superconscious. An early illumination from above or rending of the upper velamen can come as an outcome of aspiration or some inner readiness, or it may even come uncalled for or not called for by any conscious part of the mind, perhaps by a secret subliminal necessity or by an action or pressure from the higher levels, by something which is felt as the touch of the divine being, the touch of the spirit, and its results can be exceedingly powerful. But if it is brought about by a premature pressure from below, it can be attended with difficulties and dangers which are absent, and the full psychic emergence precedes this first admission to the superior ranges of our spiritual evolution. The choice, however, does not always rest with our will, for the operations of spiritual evolution in us are very various, and according to the line it has followed, will take the turn taken at any critical phase by the action of the consciousness force in its urge towards a higher manifestation and formation of our existence.
So this is where Sri Aurobindo is showing the necessity of the cosmic realization and the cosmic transformation. And particularly, and that which is beyond that, the superconscient or supramental. And particularly, it is because psychic being can bring us experiences of the spirit and a sense of the cosmic reality. But in the key of the cosmic nature of ignorance, in that ignorance, the very hallmark of ignorance is separativeness, and the highest power of ignorance is mind, whose very law is to separate. Mind is the beginning of the ignorance avidya, because its prakriti is avidya prakriti. It operates through a concentration by which it separates. It pries open the unity of the one, of the Purusha, and is instrumental in the sacrifice of Purusha. It creates the khanda by which the one is divided into the many. So long as realization is occurring under the law of that dividing consciousness, the power of that dividing consciousness, it cannot but remain incomplete in its knowledge of truth, knowledge of its own origin, or of that which is the reality. So that's what yields the necessity for the rise to an origin consciousness in which the cosmic reality is seen as the single reality. Okay. So, Sri Aurobindo is pointing out here that indeed, what I was saying earlier, can happen even independently of the psychic change. In fact, many schools have proceeded along that direction. But on the other hand, the psychic change, if it is incomplete, if there is an inner mystic transformation which is partial, which happens in many cases of many mystics, one might say, even people who are mystic poets, for example, there is a very fine expression which bears the evidence of some kind of divine inner relationship, but it doesn't go far enough. It doesn't go into the experience of the one, or even into the fullness of the transformed psychic nature. So in either case, there is a limitation. In the case of psychic which is incomplete, the need for the emergence of a higher power of consciousness that overcomes the divisiveness and, you know, the kind of incompleteness of the law of truth does not arise. That need does not arise because this is a very, very interesting sort of aspect of the whole thing. Because until and unless that in one which carries in itself the intuition of what is missing can inform the nature is not interested in it. See, this is a really interesting aspect of the whole thing because this law applies in so many cases. It applies even to the normal case where normal human beings are satisfied with their ignorance. They're satisfied with the ignorance because whatever it is that is the power of seeking in them has not emerged sufficiently with the intuition of what is beyond. The intuition of what is beyond already carries the knowledge of that realization. Once that enters into the nature, one cannot rest anymore. One becomes dissatisfied. That's what Sri Aurobindo is calling the divine discontent. So, until the psychic realization completes itself sufficiently, there isn't a sufficient understanding of why one needs to go beyond it. On the other hand, as far as the cosmic realization is concerned, there may be a cosmic realization, but that may be sufficient to itself. See, no need of the evolutionary nissus, as he calls it, is experienced. On the other hand, it may also have its own kind of incompleteness, as he's saying. That is, that there can be difficulties and dangers which are brought out because the nature is not ready for this. So what happens in that case is that there is a ascent into some kind of other rarefied condition. And either a rejection of the nature life or a nature life which is at variance with whatever one is experiencing at the level of the cosmic realization. But these things can happen separately, and that's the reason in that second part of that paragraph, Sri Aurobindo is pointing out the various ways by which one may have this cosmic realization. It may not be necessary for the psychic to prepare the nature and then proceed to this point. He's saying that of the various ways that can happen, he's saying that, you know, this may happen long before the psycho-spiritual change is complete or even before it has well begun or proceeded far. Because the psychic personality has become aware and has an eager concentration towards the superconscious. So this may happen that instead of proceeding to transform the nature and purify the mind, vital and subtle physical, the innermost being in us might impel some part of the nature to open itself directly to the Brahman or to the cosmic consciousness at that level. So an early illumination from above, that's the other way that it may happen, that there is something from above which automatically acts and opens up the nature. A rending of the upper velament can come as an outcome of aspiration or some inner readiness. This may happen behind the surface and we are not even aware of it. Or it may come uncalled for or not called for by any conscious part of the mind, perhaps by a secret subliminal necessity or by an action of pressure from the higher levels. It's something which is felt as the touch of the divine being, the touch of the spirit. So these are the variety of ways in which this aspect, the second, the beginning of the second of the transformations may come at any point. And Sri Aurobindo points out at the end of that paragraph that though we may speak of a certain progression in these matters, which is desirable, in reality we can never predict what is going to happen. Because he says the choice does not always rest with our will. For the operations of the spiritual evolution in us are very various, and according to the line it has followed will be the turn taken at any critical phase by the action of the consciousness force in its urge towards a higher self-manifestation and formation of our existence. But that said, he is making the case that the safest way and the most enduring way is if the psychic emerges and prepares the nature so that the nature is ripe for the ascent and descent of the spiritual consciousness.
Do you have some examples of the last part that Sri Aurobindo made, that it can take different paths?
Yeah, that's the point I was making, that in general, people have had cosmic realization without the psychic realization. This has been the more common, quote-unquote, Indian path, you may say. See, except for the devotional paths, where we have the other difficulty, where usually what has happened with the devotional paths is that there has been a partial transformation of the emotional nature, and realizing and bringing a psychic into the front of the emotional being, and realization of relationship with the divine that comes from that. But the larger part of Indian spirituality has proceeded in the direction of some kind of subliminal aspiration directly towards the divine above and cosmic realization. Either whether you call it from the viewpoint of Buddhism as Nirvana, or you call it as Advaita Vedanta, or even to some extent Vishishtadvaita, all these are forms of cosmic realization that have proceeded without actually preparing the rest of the nature, but taking one strand of consciousness and just aspiring for the beyond. So it's really the aspiration for the beyond, that might precede or even preclude the coming to the front of the psychic being. Mm-hmm. Now, in that case, also the psychic is involved. You see, that's the thing about actually, every aspiration for the spirit is seeded in us by the psychic being. But the psychic is acting through some part of the consciousness, has not come to the front, is acting through some other part, one of the other beings, mental, vital, or physical being. And that particular part has exceeded its own capacities and is thirsting for a direct realization of the divine. So at that point, particularly if it is the mind, there is a breaking of the veil and a rising into some cosmic existence, or the call from that particular consciousness brings a response that causes the, cosmic realization to become the touch of the divine. So that's what he's saying, that can happen. Now, when that happens, what are we left with? We are either left with a consciousness that is not really ready for it in the rest of the being, on the rest of the nature, so it withdraws into a trance, or it withdraws into a kind of minimal activity state, or else it continues to act, but the action of the consciousness is at variance. So there is a rising and falling of that particular experience. The rest of the being continues to act the way it acted before. And it may even act in a worse way, because now what has happened is that once some part of the nature becomes aware that something tremendous has been experienced by another part of the nature, the ego may appropriate it and say that I am God. This happens quite a lot, because in some way or the other, some distortion of, egoistic distortion of this realization falls on the nature instruments. And that's why he's talking about, that deformation, the titanic deformation which might occur, even in this case.
So, the realization of the self, like Raman Maharshi did, that is also in the second, that's not actually the psychic realization, right? That's a spiritual realization.
Yeah, that can be a consequence of the spiritual realization on an unprepared nature. See, that can happen if one, I wouldn't call it a full realization, that can happen if there is a experience of a higher cosmic reality on an unprepared nature. That's why he's saying, if it is brought about by premature pressure from below, it can be attended with difficulties and dangers which are absent when the full psychic emergence precedes this first admission to the superior ranges of our spiritual evolution. In other words, the being gets disbalanced because the nature translates this experience into other egoistic terms or into terms which it can't understand at all. It can go mad. It can become disordered, you see. This is where, Mother and Sri Aurobindo have used the term pulling the force. Mm-hmm. The idea of pulling the force is related to this, exactly what he's saying over here. Brought about by premature pressure from below. This premature pressure from below can be an over-eagerness of some unprepared part of the being under the influence of the ego to open to something higher. Mm-hmm. Which happens, and then there isn't the ability to contain it, and so there is a disbalancing of the nature that takes place.
Mm-hmm. So, in the case of Raman Maharshi, when he realized the self, that was the cosmic realization, right?
Yeah, undoubtedly, that was a mm-hmm. cosmic realization. He had it through the Antaratman. But it was definitely a cosmic realization.
Mm-hmm. Did he already have the psychic realization before that?
No, he does not talk of the psychic realization. But you see, the thing is that he went to the psychic entity. That's why it's the Antaratman realization. Now, in his case, it was followed by a disbalancing of the nature where he went into a kind of a non-functional or dysfunctional condition for a long time. But you see, we have to also see that in a lot of these cases, particularly the successful cases, people like Raman Maharshi, they become extremely successful because they express such a tremendously high level of spiritual radiance that they are the ones that remain in history in a way. You know, the Buddhas and Raman Maharshis and the Sri Ramakrishnas. Now, you can say they're exceptional beings because the nature was evidently the Adhara. The nature was evidently highly pure. The nature was either already purified by the psychic being without his even knowing it, or already came like that. He came with a nature which was already extremely purified. So, in these cases, invisibly, this kind of purification may occur. But when the cosmic realization is had, there is often a disbalancing that takes place, which is at least temporary. But because of the Adhara being exceptional, there is a continuation. It was a remarkably fulfilled example of the Advaitic realization. Because, like Paul Brunton says, he lived the Brahman 24 hours of the day. Now, in terms of expression, one may say it was a minimized expression. But nevertheless, the entire nature was involved in that expression. And it held, what Sri Aurobindo calls Dharana Samarthya. It had the ability to hold that Brahman realization in its nature.
So, So, Dabhashita, how is it that most traditional Indian spiritual paths talk about this, the realization of the spiritual realization, without addressing the issue of the disbalancing?
Yeah, that happens largely, that is partly the reason why there is such an emphasis on yamas, niyamas, and also the presence and direction of the guru. So there is a certain kind of disciplining of the nature that takes place. This is not a purification of the nature from within, but a disciplining of the nature and a setting of limits to expression. That is how the Indian tradition has dealt with it. And the other aspect of it is by cultivating vairagya. So that becomes privileged as a kind of way by which the nature can be kept under-expressed, you may say. See? So, if there is a valorization of this kind of vairagya, then it is possible to have these cosmic realizations and keep one's expression at a minimum. Now, why has the Indian tradition developed this kind of direction? That is another question altogether. But evidently, it has developed this direction because, to some extent, there was a feeling that life is an imprisonment. You know, this notion of Mayavada, that we are imprisoned under the condition of ignorance, and we have to escape from it, becomes at a certain point in history, Indian history, a predominant trend. And, you know, if you study culture, you find that this is the case with all forms of culture, that, you know, at a certain point, an accident of intellectual history takes place. And after that, you know, there is a cascading of that particular direction. And this has happened in the Indian case, where the notion of emergence of psychic being has not been fully addressed.
Devashishda?
Yeah.
Is this, I have two questions. Is this aperture and thinning of the mind, is it a physical phenomenon? What called as, you know, like a cup in traditional sense, where it is raising of the kundalini forces the brahmarandra to open, and without the proper direction this will break open, and basically that is the liberation and also passage into the leaving of the physical body. And a lot of times it is talked about it in that way. Is that a physical phenomenon?
Well, that is an aspect of it, but what he is actually talking about, the lid over here, is not the Brahmarandra. The Brahmarandra is an aspect of it, undoubtedly, and that is, you know, not really physical, but subtle physical. But also, because the energies can be extremely powerful, it can have physical effects as well. There can be disbalancing, there can be, upset of the physical nature as a result of that. But what he's talking about over here is the breaking of the lid as a spiritual reality, far above the Brahmarandra. It's where, at the level of overmind or thereabouts, that the division between Vidya and Avidya has taken place. That is the level at which he's saying there is a lid that has taken place because of the, you know, the divisions, division is accomplished. It's in the light divine itself, but he discusses it. He's talking about how the division is accomplished. It's kind of, it's a very interesting thing. It's where concentration of chit causes a certain kind of almost like a kind of a layer of reflection, where there is such a powerful intensity of consciousness that the light can't pass through. It seems as if the light is being reflected from that surface. Anything that is hitting it is only coming back from it. So there is a certain layer of consciousness like that, which is what he's talking about over here as needing to be rendered. But at a lower level, you know, in the rise of Kundalini Shakti, you can talk about Brahmarandhra. But in this year, this process he's talking about, that intensity or the build-up of that intensity from the inner being is diffused to some extent by the widening of consciousness. That's why this cosmic consciousness idea, the preparation that he's talking about, is something that widens the consciousness from within. And as the consciousness widens from within, this inner intensity of otherwise raising Kundalini becomes a much more gradual process, or it actually rises in a more subtle manner. And this danger of, division between mind and higher mind is not sensed in the same way, you see. So I'd say that to answer your question, firstly, that lid that he's talking about is higher lid. But there is some aspect of what you're talking about which is implied here, particularly in the notion of pulling of force, you see.
Because in the life story of Ganapati Muni, it was said that he, in his later years, after Uma Sahasram writing and all that, he had a physical opening and basically he lived with it about a year or so. Because of his intense sadhana, and he finally passed out like that. And also many of the siddha practice, and they talk about kapala moksha, kapala siddhi, very literally.
That's I agree. Yeah. So that can be an aspect of this, certainly, because of the intensity of force, which is accumulated and in its upward movement can cause physical effects of that kind. That's why there also it is very important that this gradual preparation can widen the consciousness so that that intensity is diffused over a wider, kind of reality, wider consciousness.
Yeah, I had related to that. The second question I had was lot of times I heard that in babies who are month old, and they don't have this this part well formed, so that they say that they are in constant communion with the divine because of that. Is there any truth to that?
I don't know about that, Shiva, but I can tell you this, that I know that maybe physically speaking, that part of the skull may be softer or whatever. But because the mind is not well prepared, in fact, if this intensity of cosmic consciousness was to pass into a child, it could even create madness and deformation of the brain. This is partly the reason why Sri Aurobindo and the mother would not allow children under the age of 6 or whatever, even more, to come for the darshans. It was a rule. And when asked, this is what the mother said, that the intensity of divine energy could even cause them to become deformed mentally for the rest of their lives.
Thank you.
Sitaram, would you like to read the next paragraph?
If the rift in the lid of mind is made, what happens is an opening of vision to something above us, or a rising up towards it, or a descent of powers into our being. What we see by the opening of the vision is an infinity above us, an eternal presence, or an infinite existence. an infinity of consciousness, an infinity of bliss, a boundless self, a boundless light, a boundless power, a boundless ecstasy. It may be that for a long time, all that is obtained is the occasional or frequent or constant vision of it, and a longing and an aspiration, but without any further, because although something in the mind, heart or other part of the being has opened to this experience, the lower nature as a whole is too heavy and obscure as at for more. But there may be, instead of this first wide awareness from below, or subsequently to it, an ascension of the mind to heights above. The nature of these heights we may not know or clearly discern, but some consequence of the ascent is felt. There is often too an awareness of infinite ascension and return, but no record or translation of that higher state. This is because it has been superconscient to mind, and therefore mind, when it rises into it, is unable at first to retain there its power of consciousness, conscious discernment and defining experience. But when this power begins to awake and act, when mind becomes by degrees conscious in what was to it superconscient, then there begins a knowledge and experience of superior planes of existence. The experience is in accord with that which is brought to us by the first opening of the vision. The mind rises into the higher plane of pure self, silent, tranquil, illimitable, or it rises into regions of light or felicity, or into planes where it feels an infinite power or divine presence, or experiences the contact of a divine love or beauty, or the atmosphere of a wider and greater and luminous knowledge. In the return of the spiritual impression abides, but the mental record is often blurred and remains as a vague or a fragmentary memory. The lower consciousness from which the ascent took place falls back to what it was, with only the addition of an unkept or a remembered but no longer dynamic experience. In time, the ascent comes to be made at will, and the consciousness brings back and retains some effect or some gain of its temporary sojourn in these higher countries of the spirit. These ascents take place for many in trance, but are perfectly possible in a concentration of the waking consciousness, or where that consciousness has become sufficiently psychic at any unconcentrated moment by an upward attraction or affinity. But these two types of contact with the superconscient, though they can be powerfully illuminating, ecstatic or liberating, are by themselves insufficiently effective. For the full spiritual transformation, more is needed. A permanent ascension from the lower into the higher consciousness, and an effectual permanent descent of the higher into the lower nature.
So one sees that in this process that he has been describing, there are some kinds of transitions that take place which are of a sort of analogous nature, you know. One is that earlier this was a similar kind of movement or process taking place within. Sri Aurobindo first talked about the psychology of normal existence, which is lived on the surface, and then pointed to what is the center within us, And to arrive at that center within, there was a process of going deeper and deeper within until we arrived at a certain station of consciousness, a status, one may say, of the person within, which was psychic. Now, that then, or in that process, or accompanying that process, there is also a change in the consciousness of the nature. The change of the consciousness of the nature is a mediated process by the psychic being, which thins the crust of the surface. See, you see there again, there was the two things. One is changing the center of one's existence, and the other is thinning the crust of the nature. So here, in that case, both these sort of processes were related to the inner being. Where do we change the center into? As far as the inner being is concerned, we move progressively from the nature and its multiplicity, or from the ego to the inner nature, to the various purushas, and ultimately to the psychic being. But in this process, we have to actually change our nature itself. And that is accomplished through the action of the psychic thinning the crust, as he calls it. That thinning of the crust is the transformation of the nature, which becomes more and more plastic to the psychic consciousness. Now here, the two analogous processes that are taking place relate to the upper reality and the upper higher purusha. So there has to be a thinning of the crust of the mental existence in its division between the mind and that which is above it. In this particular case, it has not gone as high as the supermind, but this notion of a crust, you know, I mean, whether you talk about it as a Brahmarandhra or you talk about it as a subtle spiritual crust that exists between human mind and the higher mind and the cosmic mind planes with the overmind above, that crust also is something which first thins and transforms in its nature and its quality through the action of the psychic being. So as this action proceeds, that is part of the preparation of the mind that becomes, as it were, more transparent and allows this kind of influence from above to occur without this strict sense of a division. See, now it is because that process happens gradually that the danger is mitigated of these things like sudden bursts from above or from below, and instead there is a gradual sense of an opening up of the mind to something which is infinite above. Now, this is the key aspect that he's talking about in this particular paragraph, that a sense of the infinite develops above the mind. There is a concrete sense that there is something above the mind which is infinite, whether it is infinite knowledge, infinite delight, infinite power, infinite existence. It is the concrete sense of the infinite above the mind or above the consciousness that is the sign of the thinning of the veil and maybe the rending of the veil. Okay. Now, he's pointing out that must occur at some point. That is a precursor to the possibility of experiencing cosmic consciousness in its own home, okay, not in some other level, that what the Veda calls Svedami, in its own abode. So that particular sense, once it arises, is the beginning of the ascent into cosmic consciousness. Then there has to come gradually the aspiration for rising into that level, and the nature also has to reduce further its density so that it can actually be more in tune with that infinite being, infinite consciousness. Now, what he's pointing out is that at that point, invisible ascents and descents may take place, which one may not even remember. They may take place in meditation, in trance, in sleep, and maybe even in waking, where one is not aware of what really happened. One just carries a rough impress of an experience in which there has been a passage into something higher and greater. But it's only when, and these things are usually what go by the name of Sushupti, and in the avasthas, as talked of in the Mandukya Upanishad and later literature. But this state of Sushupti is only really, and Mother brings this out very powerfully, she says it's only as a result of the fact that there is a gap of consciousness, that the consciousness has not been prepared to be a continuity between that and what we are. So building that becomes the real beginning of the reversal of consciousness. Reversal of consciousness in the sense that whatever Prakriti has done so far in building a nature that can house Purusha has now turned into Purusha's own hands. Now the building process, the formation process of a new nature, a new consciousness begins as a power mediated by Purusha itself. Now this is what, you know, in a technical sense, and since you were talking about the Brahmarandhra, etc., occurs in the opening up of the thousand-petaled lotus and in moving beyond it. Thousand-petaled lotus closes in itself higher possibilities of centers which are not active in cosmic nature at this point. Thousand-petaled lotus is situated at the level of higher mind. But from there has to be established a center for overmind, and even beyond that, a center for supermind. These don't exist in cosmic nature, particularly at the individual level. So this process is a process of the formation of these things. So that's the reason why there is a true creative process that accompanies the second and third transformations. So here in this paragraph, it's very esoteric paragraph, because as he ends the paragraph, he's talking about the various stages. First entering into these, first being able to conceive of these planes in a concrete sense, through the concrete sense, the inner sense of infinity that must arise. In the manas must develop the sense of infinity. Then there must be experiences of rising into it, which may not be remembered, may be of the Sushupti nature. Then there must be gradually experiences of rise and fall, which are retained in memory. Then there must be a willed ability to enter into these levels. And as he says, there too there may be two possibilities. One is through a power of concentration, and the other is through a direct passage just by will. Now a lot of these things are ultimately also very fine distinctions that Sri Aurobindo is making in the record of yoga. Mm-hmm. He has terms for all these things. And finally, he's saying this process is not complete until there is a change of center. Just as in the case of the inner being, it is not complete until there is a change of center and one resides in the psychic being. So too, there isn't a change of completion until one rises to these new centers and takes one's seat there. To be able to reside with one's center of consciousness above the mind and to bring the plane of consciousness, the nature of that Purusha, into the human mind, life and body is the second of the three transformations.
Devashishta, what is the difference between concentration, entering into it by concentration and by will? What is the difference between these two?
The difference, Sita, is that by concentration, you're making an effort. It's a greater effort. There has to be a bringing together of the nature and a forcing of the energy in that direction. In doing it by will, this will is just like kamana. I want to do it. I want to walk. Because in the beginning, it's almost like you can take the analogy of the child who first must make an effort to walk. Every time the child wants to walk, there has to be a gathering together of the consciousness in the learning of the lesson of walking. But once it becomes second nature, it's only the cognitive will that says, I want to walk, and the rest of the being starts walking. So it's that pure wanting which immediately affects without putting a willful concentration in it. This act of power, I was saying that these words are used by Sri Aurobindo in Record of Yoga. This distinction which you just asked formulates the three terms, Vashita, Ishita, and there's one more.
Prakamya.
I think that's what it is. Prakamya, Vashita, and Ishita. These are the three. So Ishita is the one where it is just by will. Vashita is the one where concentration is required. And Ishita is the one where just by will one achieves whatever one wants to achieve.
So does it mean that we have to start with our will first to get to understand? No, we should have will to...
Yeah, we must have will, undoubtedly we must have will. But we also have to put effort. So the will becomes, expressed through all the entire nature, through concentration and effort. But once a certain stage is reached, it is the purity of will that remains. No more concentration is required.
So automatically it becomes natural flow. Like we don't have to put in any effort or any will there.
The will is still there. The will is automatic. But the will is there. Like, for example, it's like a wish, you see. Like, let me give a more concrete example. If I will that I want to eat some laddus right now, I will have to do something to go to a shop and buy the laddus.
To show us the house on Saturday.
But on the other hand, if I just will, I want to eat some laddus. It's just a thought in the mind, and the laddus appear in front of me. That's the difference between concentration with will and will without any concentration. It's just the pure thought that I want which makes it happen.
Thank you. So pure thought of it makes it happen, then is that means that we are always in that mode of concentration so that we don't have to put in any effort?
Yeah, whether it's a mode of concentration or it's a change of consciousness, it may be a change of consciousness in which that particular, power is automatic. Say again, I'll give you another example which is probably closer to this. That is, let's say, in developing the power of poetry. Like Sri Aurobindo says, he used to... sit down at a certain point of time, at a certain time every day, and allow poetry to come to him. And sometimes some poetry would come, and sometimes it wouldn't come. He says, it's the inspiration that has to be brought under one's control. Now, that involves a concentration. You sit there and concentrate on a certain theme, and kind of see if some high poetry is going to come up from you. Now, once it reaches a certain point, as soon as you sit down, the poetry starts coming. As soon as you say, oh, poetry come, it starts coming. You see, that basically a change in consciousness has taken place where just the wish can make it happen.
Thank you.
It's 9:23. Perhaps we can read one more Devashishta.
Yeah, sure. We can read one more. Because essentially he has brought us to the critical point in this second transformation, and he's kind of clubbing the two together to some extent because the process is the same.
Sure.
It's interesting that this notion of thinning of the veil and changing of center is the analog, which is being the pattern, one may say, which is being repeated. Firstly, it is done within, then it is done above, and again it is done above. Again, there is another veil. That veil is the veil between the overmind and the supermind. And that center that has to be sort of changed is again between the cosmic consciousness and the transcendental consciousness. But essentially, what he's pointing to is the fact that there has to be a change of center, which is really a change of the Purusha, change of the status of the Purusha. Where is it that I'm located? From where am I acting? And what is it that occupies the consciousness of the actor?
Saroja, would you like to read?
Yeah, sure.
This is the third motion. The descent, which is essential for bringing the permanent ascension, an increasing inflow from above, an experience of reception and retention of the descending spirit or its powers and elements of consciousness. This experience of descent can take place as a result of the other two movements or automatically before either has happened. Through a sudden rift in the lid or a percolation, a downpour or an influx, a light descends and touches or envelopes or penetrates the lower being, the mind, the life of the body, or a presence or a power or a stream of knowledge, forcing waves or currents, or there is a flood of bliss or a sudden ecstasy, the contact with the superconscient has been established. But such experiences repeat themselves till they have become normal, familiar and well understood. Revelatory of their contents and their significance, which we have at first been involved and wrapped into secrecy by the figure of the covering experience. For a knowledge from above begins to descend frequently, constantly, then uninterruptedly, and to manifest in the mind's quietude or silence. Intuitions and inspirations, revelations born of the greater sight, a higher truth and wisdom, enter into the being, a luminous intuitive discrimination works, which dispels all darkness of understanding, our dazzling confusions, puts all in order. A new consciousness begins to form. The mind of a high height, self-existent thinking, knowledge, or an illumined, or an intuitive, or an over-mental consciousness with new forces of thought, or sight and greater power of direct spiritual realization, which is more than thought or sight, a greater becoming in the spiritual substance of our present being. The heart and the sense become subtle, intense, large to embrace all existence, to see God, to feel and hear and touch the eternal, to make a deeper and closer unity of self and the world in a transcendent realization, other decisive experiences, other changes of consciousness determine themselves, which are corollaries and consequences of this fundamental change. No limit can be fixed to this revolution, for it is in its nature an invasion by the infinite.
So, actually over here, Sri Aurobindo is talking about the descent of this power, that whatever we can achieve through our own consciousness, even the ability to rise into these higher planes, they must ultimately be a possibility which invites downwards the full consciousness of the divine into our nature. And that descent is what he's talking about here. Now, what is interesting is that in this particular formulation that he has given us of the triple transformation, there is an emergence of the psychic being, which is given in a way the greatest, priority. But also this emergence is facilitated by a surrender of the being in its mind, vital and physical activities, and in its ability to travel within and reside in the purushas of mind, vital and physical, a surrender in all these to the Ishvara, to the Supreme Being, to the Supreme Person, Purushottama and Ishvara. In a way, that is a following of the yoga of the Gita. And through that, opening up of personal power in relationship with the Supreme Being, there is a yoga or a yogic consciousness that enlarges itself, subtilizes the human nature, subtilizes the limit between human nature and divine nature, goes through these kind of experiences of rise and fall, and ultimately only when it has reached a certain level, the descent from above begins to take place. Now, what is sort of underplayed in this description to some extent is what Sri Aurobindo foregrounds in later expressions of the same process, where instead of the surrender to Purusha, he prioritizes the surrender to Shakti, to the Divine Mother. Now, the question has to be asked, what exactly is the role of the Divine Mother in all this? Of course, he's saying that once the psychic being comes to the front, to the extent that it comes to the front, both Ishvara and Shakti become realities to the person. But it is, how is it taking place? This entire process he has talked about, what is the agent? What is the agency that is causing this to happen? So far it seems the agency is human will, which is making the surrender. The act of surrender is the key to the yoga, that to whatever extent the will is managing in its mental, vital and physical activities to make the surrender to the Ishvara is causing the psychic to gradually get hold of the inner nature, transform it and come to the front, and then automatically to that extent start doing this really difficult thing that he has talked about in this last paragraph, of opening up the, thinning the lid, getting the sense of the infinite, transforming the manas and chitta, and rising above into Sushupti, and then shuttling between, mind and sort of overmind, through these stages that may be thought of as Prakamya, Vashita, Nishita, etc. In a way, what he has given us is almost what he has himself followed, which is the record of yoga, in the record of yoga. But in this very difficult process, the agency is concealed because it is not really by our own power that we can do all these things. There has to be another hidden power that is at work, that is ultimately allowing all these steps to be formed in us. This formation of these forms of consciousness, these centers of consciousness, these almost inconceivable steps that he has, encapsulated in such brevity in these paragraphs. The true agency is the Shakti. So here, what is happening is that once he has brought it to this point, where this really difficult transition between humanity and the future is taking place, he comes to this point where he says, we can go so far and no further. Even in our psychic transformation, we can develop the consciousness to this extent where we can thin the lid and pass above into the sense of the infinite, become united with it, but we can't reside there. We have to keep dropping back and shuttling back and forth by will. But at a certain point, that does not suffice anymore. The divine has to take in our consciousness. And that stage of the transformation is initiated by this downpour of Shakti from above. This prepared Adhara becomes the receptacle for what he calls so boldly the invasion of the infinite. Now, this invasion of the infinite, however, has been going on from the very beginning. And this is partly why, at a later stage, he's going to say, make your surrender consciously to the Shakti. Because it is the Shakti that does all these things. And that gradually descends into us. That rends the veil. He uses that term in the book, the mother. That prepares the Adhara, that rends the veil, and that pours herself into us. See? So this motion that he's talking about, this is the third motion, the descent. It is the direct action of the divine Shakti, which is initiated after the Adhara has been prepared sufficiently. But even that preparation has been done by her. And this is the reason why he's saying, if the surrender is made to her, she acts incalculably. We can't predict her steps. They are too complex, too many-sided, and too quick for even the fastest and most complex intelligence to keep up with. And what does she do? Not only does she prepare us by these incursions of divinity, she also forms the ability for us to understand what she is doing. This is the conversion of our consciousness to an intuitive consciousness. It proceeds from the normal human consciousness through an intuitive consciousness into a divine consciousness. So that's why he's saying over here that once this happens, it is like almost unbearable experience, but it prepares the Adhara, widens it, makes it more ready to receive this again and again. That's why he's using that term. This experience of descent can take place as a result of the other two movements. That is, all this long preparation and the ability to thin the higher consciousness, the veil, and to rise by concentration or to rise by will. All this has been done. And then the experience of descent can take place as a result of that, you know, because it's almost like the process of evolution in Sri Aurobindo always proceeds by this double movement of ascent and descent. So the ascent has gone as far as it can, so far, that it has now invoked the power of higher consciousness to descend. So it can either happen like that, or it can happen automatically. Before either has happened, through a sudden rift in the lid, or a percolation. A percolation is, it's a very interesting term. The rift implies something sudden, like a kind of a rupture. But a percolation is a gradual diffusion, is a moving through from one medium to another by seepage. That's the percolation. That percolation is a preparation. It prepares. Percolation prepares. Or it can be a downpour, which is like a rain that comes in a tremendous, number of points of entry and enters in or influx. So all these are varieties of movement between the one medium above and the other medium below, between which there is a gap. Now, all these can happen, but we don't understand what has happened. We just bear the intensity of the happening. You see, that's why he's saying, for a knowledge from above begins to, but before that, for such experiences repeat themselves till they become normal, familiar, and well understood. And then we begin to understand what it is. Because that Shakti, it forms a kind of knowledge within us. A knowledge from above begins to descend frequently, constantly, uninterruptedly, and manifest in the mind's quietude or silence. It shows us what it is. Intuitions and inspirations, revelations born of a greater sight, a higher truth and wisdom enter into the being. A luminous intuitive discrimination works which dispels all darkness of understanding or dazzling confusions, puts all in order. This ordering consciousness is the very essence of the Divine Mother. It is that consciousness that orders the entire terrain and prepares it for a new working. Otherwise impossible to us, because we don't know how we are to set it in place. A new consciousness begins to form. That word is very important. It's a new consciousness, not just a new consciousness that appears, begins to form. The mind of a high, wide, self-existent thinking knowledge, or an illumined, or an intuitive, or an over-mental consciousness, with new forces of thought or sight, and a greater power of direct spiritual realization, which is more than thought or sight, a greater becoming in the spiritual substance of our present being. So this is the transition to another kind of consciousness of knowledge and action. Not only knowledge and action, but also feeling. Because the heart transforms, the heart and the sensations transform, the sense, they become subtle, intense, large to embrace all existence, to see God. This is very, very powerful. And it's some of the things that Sri Aurobindo is talking about in the Record of Yoga also, where he's saying that everything is the divine and life is not really attained in its fullness until all one can sense, see, touch, hear, smell, eat is nothing but the divine. See, that is the pitch or intensity of the realization of the divine that he's talking about over here. And it can only be brought into us through the descent of the Shakti, who has prepared us and then establishes herself in us.
Devashishji, it's very beautifully said, and the explanation is also wonderful. Thank you for that. But it just makes me wonder, in Bhagavad Gita, when Sri Krishna gives his Vishwarupa to Arjuna, Arjuna being Avatar Purusha, and he's been gone through so much of yoga and by himself, and he's a close best friend and close relative of Krishna. He himself says that, "I really can't see you. Please come to a form where I can see you. I can't take your energy." So with all this preparation, with all this, the way we are slowly getting prepared, even this, the way it's explained in the book, still makes me wonder, and really the power of Shakti comes through us, that flows into us. Can we really take that?
A very good question, actually, and particularly through the comparison you made with Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita, and I completely agree with you that it is, you know, I mean, unimaginable the kind of power and the kind of consciousness that is being talked about here. And Vishwarupa is a example of that kind of supramental, you know, vision. But one thing, although we have to realize that what Arjuna is describing, and actually that's the whole, you know, kind of sense of Sri Aurobindo's work in a way, is that Arjuna represents the highest possibility of humanity in the Treta Yuga, in the Dwapara Yuga. So in the Dwapara, humankind reaches the point of evolution where he can just intuit the supermind. And that is the blessing, the prasada of Sri Krishna to humanity, not just to Arjuna. Arjuna is Aryaputra. His name literally means the upright one. And he is given that particular prasada as the key to the next revelation that will come. And that is indeed the fulfillment of this yuga. And that's why, invisible to us, preparation has gone on. Cosmic Prakriti, cosmic Shakti has assimilated that vision that was given to Arjuna in the cosmic humanity, so that even though we can't recognize it individually, we will be able to experience it when it comes. So this is my faith. And this is why Sri Aurobindo and the mother came to prepare this particular realization for humanity, not just as a vision, but as an embodiment. That's why I feel that this is possible to us now.
Thank you. I hope that these each step which makes us get ready for the next one, that's what it's supposed to mean, right?
Yes, yes, indeed, absolutely. Now, also, of course, I mean, to speak in these terms may sound very glorious and more glorious than we can encompass as we are right now. And, you know, I am the last person to actually look at humanity in that over-optimistic vein, given our own condition right now. But what I mentioned really is potential, human potential. How many people rise to that potential is another matter. But I do believe that as the whole legacy of Sri Aurobindo and the mother has been to say that that particular power is given to us, and it is for us to take it. It is for us to really aspire for it and to do whatever is necessary for it. Those who want to will, and if nobody wants to, it will still achieve its own goals. But nevertheless, this is the blessing, the prasada of their lives. And, you know, whether today or tomorrow, it will be realized.
Devashishji, shall we close here for today and continue next week?
Yes, surely.
Yeah, let's
close with the meditation.
Yes, definitely. Let's stop with a brief meditation.